from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. A decade or more ago, the Washington Post might have sold for a couple of billion dollars. This month, Amazon.com CEO Jeff Bezos bought it for $250 million. Pocket change for the internet mogul to buy one of the most storied news organizations in the country. This hour on Point, we look at struggling newspapers and their role, their future, as they merge with the digital world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you think of the new world? Jeff Bezos as newspaper man. Will the digital world support serious, civic-minded journalism? Can it make it profitable again? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will hear in this hour from Bill Keller, who was longtime top editor at the New York Times, from John Harris, who left the Washington Post to co-found the online upstart Politico. And first, with me right now from Washington, Chris Hughes, co-founder of Facebook, who last year bought the New Republic. Mark Zuckerberg's old Facebook partner is now publisher and editor-in-chief of a magazine and has been thinking a lot about the news business. Chris Hughes, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
What do you think of Jeff Bezos as a newspaper owner?
I think it's a great sign. I think it's a great sign for the industry because it's a clear vote of confidence that content matters and that people not only still crave the news but are likely to continue to want to pay for it as long as we as news owners and producers make it easy for them to do so.
Columbia Journalism Review notes this will be the first time a major newspaper has been owned by a tech revolutionary. What do you think it means that a tech revolutionary will be the guy at the top?
I think it's exciting not just because Jeff is a tech revolutionary, to use your term, but also because he is one of the largest device manufacturers. Through Amazon, the production of the Kindle is estimated to have sold millions and millions of units. And these tablets and phones as well are revolutionizing the way that people are consuming the news. If you look into what Jeff has said, separate from the Washington Post or well before he even bought the company, what he says again and again is that there's meaningful value in content as a service. You know, you can make some money selling lots of devices, iPads, phones, Kindles, what have you, but the real opportunity is with the content that people are willing to pay for on an ongoing basis, whether that's movies, music, or now in this case, the news. So I think that he's not only a visionary when it comes to, you know, obviously building great companies, but in thinking about how it's possible to monetize content in a world that even just 5 years ago, everyone assumed it was going to be impossible to do it.
Newspapers have been losing money hand over fist. Presumably that's one reason that Don Graham got out of the family business here. Do you take this as a sign that Jeff Bezos is willing to come in and subsidize this big news organization for a long time? Or do you think he's got a plan that they haven't in all their years of scrabbling around been able to find?
Well, look, I think that there's no question that he is going to have to make really meaningful investments in the business. I think anybody who's turning around a media company in 2013 has to do that. The question is there a route to profitability? Is there a route to being in the black? And if you look, you know, over at one of the other, obviously, most influential newspapers in the country, the New York Times, there's good evidence to believe that there is. Even if the print edition of the New York Times weren't produced any longer, there's signs just in this past quarter that the New York Times would still be able to not only be sustainable, but profitable. They've got $150 million of revenue coming from digital subs. Just digital subs.
Subscriptions.
And another,
yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and another $200 million coming from digital advertising. That's a lot of money. And if you assume that that's going to continue to grow on the trajectory that, at least on the circulation side, that's been the case over the past few years, you can staff at least hundreds of journalists in a newsroom. It's not the glory days of newspapers as they might have been 30 years ago, but the situation for national newspapers, I think, is a little bit more promising than the conventional wisdom would lead you to believe.
We saw that analysis by Henry Blodgett about how the Times could live on its online revenues alone. We'll ask Bill Keller about that when he comes on, Chris.
I'm sure he'll have great thoughts.
Let me ask you, here you were, a co-founder of Facebook. What, you were roommates with Mark Zuckerberg at Harvard and were involved very early on in Facebook, made a ton of money. In the digital realm, the social media realm, what are you doing in what was print? I mean, of course, the New Republic has its online version as well. What's drawn you to it? Why do we see you digital guys putting your nose over the fence here?
Well, it's two things. It's first off, a belief that journalism is important. I mean, there's no doubt that that's one of the things that is a primary motivator for me and probably is for Jeff and others as well. We need great journalism to have a healthy democracy and to be well-developed citizens. It's also a belief, though, that that there is a future in the type of ideas-driven journalism that the New Republic has done for nearly a century. And it's up to a lot of us who do come from the digital world to innovate and to think about what some of those solutions might be. You know, people still read and crave deep sort of long-form journalism just as much as they did in the past. Everyone obviously is on Twitter, on their phones all the time, and I think that the assumption that we have is that we can only digest 140 characters. In reality, there's a whole growing movement of long-form publications or media companies, whether it's Byliner, Long Reads, Long Form, ourselves, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, the list is long, who are seeing both online and in print and on tablets record amounts of traffic. So there's interest. It's just up to us to figure out a way to monetize it and make it sustainable for the long term.
I mean, it looks very much like Don Graham, who's selling to Jeff Bezos, wasn't able to do that. Let's hear him and Bezos just a little bit. Then I want to go to bring John Harris in here. Here's outgoing CEO and chairman of the Washington Post Company, Donald Graham, whose grandfather bought the paper in 1933. This was an interview with the Washington Post's video newscast, The Fold, where Graham says he believes Amazon's Bezos will do right by the paper. Here's Graham.
You know, when you think about that growing and growing and growing digital and mobile audience, Jeff knows a lot about that. He knows how to reach people, and he knows how to establish commercial relationships with advertisers and others. It's not that he's going to walk in with a prepackaged solution to the problems of the newspaper business. He is absolutely not. But he didn't do this impulsively. He did this after thinking for a couple of months.
A couple of months? Newspaper people have been thinking for almost 20 years now and not figured it out. But maybe, Chris Hughes, you're right in thinking that here we've got the Amazon man looking for content for all those Kindles. Here's Bezos. This was in Santa Monica last year at the unveiling of the Kindle family, saying that Amazon would succeed only if people spend money consuming news, books, and movies and content on the Kindle.
It's very simple. We want to make money when people use our devices, not when they buy our devices. That is better alignment. If somebody buys one of our devices and puts it in a desk drawer and never uses it, we don't deserve to make any money. Think what great alignment it is that we only make money when you use the device.
Maybe reading the Washington Post. Joining us now from Arlington, Virginia is John Harris. He spent over 20 years at the Washington Post before co-founding Politico, the very successful online political news hub, where he's now editor-in-chief. He published an article in Politico this month called What is Jeff Bezos Thinking? John Harris, welcome back to On Point.
Yes, thank you, Tom.
He wants people to use the Kindle. Well, is the Washington Post the kind of stuff that's going to bring him in, big money catnip?
I doubt that his strategy is anticipating big money, but I do think that he thinks it's an interesting experiment. And I do agree with Don Graham that what we know about Jeff Bezos to date in his career suggests that he is somebody who's got the responsibility, the values that people in my side of the business, in the newsroom, that we look to. We look for people who are conscientious, responsible, and with long-time horizons.
I'm still curious what makes you think he's got the values. I mean, here he is buying the Washington Post. That means he'll be at the head of a major news organization that's made very tough decisions to get news out over the years. And he refused to sit down for an interview with the Post.
I don't know his reasons for that. He might think, look, I'll talk about my role with the Washington Post once the deal is closed and I actually own the Washington Post. I've got a couple of reasons that I give Jeff Bezos the benefit of the doubt, and I think you're quite right. This is a tentative judgment. We'll have to see what kind of owner he is once he takes the wheel. Don Graham's assessment and appraisal of him looms large, as does Catherine Weymouth's, Don's niece and the current publisher of The Post, who says she's going to stay. I think his record at Amazon as somebody who's been more interested in long-term building of a business rather than trying to take as many profits out of it in the near term.
True.
And then, frankly, I don't think somebody would buy the Washington Post if they were interested in making a lot of bucks out of it. Somebody like him, not to be kind of too blunt about it, but he could probably make more money in a passbook savings account than he will in the Washington Post. I don't think the idea of owning it would appeal to him unless he felt that, just as Chris Hughes felt in purchasing the New Republic, that there was a franchise there and the franchise mattered more than just an economic proposition, but because of its role that it plays in American life.
Of course, long term, it's tough for things to stand if they don't figure out, stand in full, if they don't figure out how to keep a profitable stream of revenue in this country. Do you think Jeff Bezos can figure out what the Graham family could not, John?
Well, I think he's got different responsibilities than the Graham family did. The Washington Post in the early 70s made a decision that was very important to the growth of the Washington Post and to the eventual power that it amassed to go public. It gave it an enormous amount of resources. I think the kind of life cycle of that institution has changed, and they're better off in the hands of an owner who does not have the responsibilities of a public corporation that the Washington Post company is now. It just gives them the ability to have a longer time horizon. And frankly, although the Grahams are very, very well off, obviously Jeff Bezos is better off.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the future of newspapers as they merge with the digital world. Amazon's Jeff Bezos is buying the Washington Post. Where does this go? Chris Hughes is with us, co-founder of Facebook, now owner of the New Republic. John Harris is here, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Politico. He spent 21 years at the Washington Post covering politics, then moved to an all-online operation of his own. We're going to hear in just a moment from Bill Keller, longtime executive editor at the New York Times, now columnist there. Chris, John, Bill joins us in just a moment. But let's hear just a little more Jeff Bezos to get a feeling for the man who will soon be the new owner of the Washington Post. $250 million he's paying for it. Estimates are it might have sold for 10 or more times that much not long ago when newspapers were riding high. Pocket change for him. 1%, it's estimated, of Jeff Bezos' fortune. Here he is. Last year, in a fireside chat at a gathering for developers, technical leaders called AWS Invent, Jeff Bezos saying that looking for places where technology can improve functionality is fun.
If you're the right kind of person and you like to invent, you like change, and you, everything you see as you move about the world, you think how it could be improved, that's just fun. And we at Amazon, we've over the last 18 plus years attracted a bunch of people like that, and we have a ton of fun doing it.
Well, maybe the Washington Post can be improved. They can have a lot of fun. Maybe they can even make it profitable. Will they keep it a real, aggressive, civically oriented, willing to break China news organization? Will they have those deep principles? Will Jeff Bezos? Let's go way back with him. This is 2001. This is an interview with the nonprofit Academy of Achievement. Jeff Bezos saying technology should be used to improve society.
Technologies in tend to be agnostic with respect to whether they can be used for good or used for evil. And I think that over the next 50 years we are going to face a lot of very tough decisions as a society in how we make sure that we are harnessing those technologies for good purposes.
Well, that was foresight. We have arrived at that moment. Chris Hughes, John Harris, stand by. Joining us right now from Southampton, New York, is Bill Keller, New York Times executive editor until 2011, Pulitzer Prize winner, ran the whole show. Now he's an op-ed columnist for The Times. Bill Keller, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
How are you thinking about Jeff Bezos' purchase of your longtime competitor at The New York Times, The Washington Post?
Well, as a completely impartial observer of the newspaper scene,
right.
I think on balance that it's a good thing. I tend to think of people like Bezos and Chris Hughes, not to suck up to one of your other guests, but Bill Gates in a different realm, as kind of the kind of Carnegies and Rockefellers of our time, and there is a public spiritedness some of which, of course, is to look good in the eyes of the world. But I think there's a genuine commitment to doing good and, you know, keeping democracy vibrant. So I think Bezos, until I'm proven wrong, mm-hmm. I will assume that Bezos' intentions are good. I don't think he bought the Washington Post to kill it or run it into the ground or ruin it or embarrass himself by turning it into something superficial or even, and this is maybe a question you want to look into a little more, mm-hmm. even to advance his own other corporate interests. Because, you know, there is some potential conflict there. He heads a very large company that deals with a lot of layers of government on regulatory issues, on sales taxes for online retailing, for example. Some of his competitors regard him as predatory.
Sure.
So there is the question of whether the Post then becomes an instrument of his own interests.
I mean, you raise a couple of big issues there. We'll look at them with Chris and John as well. But are you saying when you compare Jeff and our Chris here, Facebook zillionaire, to Rockefeller and Carnegie, that you expect them to run these as philanthropies, Bill?
No, but I think that there is a genuine commitment to. I think Chris is too young to think about his legacy, but maybe Bill Gates is not. Mm-hmm. To begin thinking about how they want to be remembered in history, and they want to be remembered for having made a mark for good, not just for having acquired a huge stockpile of cash.
Chris, have you picked up the New Republic to run it as a philanthropy?
No, I haven't. But we also recognize it's a double bottom line business. I mean, by that, I mean, there's a public good in the journalism that we do that, motivates every action of the newsroom on a day-to-day basis. But, for me and for a lot of folks on our business side, we also see that there's, hopefully a sustainable future here. I don't think that anybody is crazy enough to think that we're going to be printing money or anybody's going to be getting rich off of this sector in general. But I do think that there is a route to sustainability while also recognizing that what we do is a public good.
John Harris, be our hard-bitten reporter here. Do you believe that as Bill suggests is possible, that Jeff Bezos is not buying the Washington Post to advance his other corporate interests?
I'd be hard-pressed to believe that that's a primary motive of him. But whether it's a motive or not, there's going to be instances, as I think Bill shrewdly points out, where the conflict does come in, does arise in kind of a glaring light. And it will be interesting to see how the publication deals with that. It's not a new issue, by the way. The Washington Post, under its current ownership, has a lot of regulatory issues, both with its TV station and its education online business, Stanley Kaplan. So,
I mean, maybe I'm the cynic, but I have a hard time believing
this is not a new issue for the owners of media companies, but how one handles that, is there transparency, is there accountability, is one of the tests that publishers face.
I mean, but here, Bill Keller, here's a businessman who, by his own description, has really almost literally been bent on global domination. I mean, he wants to sell everything on Earth. The Amazon had to be the biggest river. Industry after industry he's come into. This is not a guy with modest business ambitions. It almost seem infinite. And he's got that hunger for material on his Kindle. I mean, surely his business interests are running through this purchase, even if it's only 1% of his fortune to make it.
Well, sure. I don't think he's, as you kind of jokingly put it, I don't think he's in this strictly as a philanthropic enterprise. Mm. But he's going to be watched very, very closely. Whether he wants to give interviews to the Washington Post now mm-hmm. or give them later, mm-hmm. You don't have to give interviews to newspapers to have them turning over every aspect of your life and probing deeply. And I expect, including journalists at the Washington Post, he already has gotten a considerable amount of scrutiny, some of it very skeptical. There are a lot of long pieces have run over the last days, since this acquisition was announced.
Yep.
So, and I don't think he wants to spend his life, waiting through scandals.
Chris, I mean, you bought the New Republic, and now you're publisher and editor-in-chief. What do you anticipate in terms of Bezos being hands-on here? I'm reading, and this is from a great long piece that ran in the New York Times, quoting a former employee at Amazon saying that Jeff Bezos makes ordinary control freaks look like stoned hippies. I mean, this is a guy who gets in there right down to the finest grain operation.
Yeah, well, a couple things. Just on that last point of whether or not Jeff's politically motivated, I think that if he were, there are all kinds of things that he could have bought instead of the Post. If anything, the Post would be the most difficult news institution to run to actually try to reorient journalists, editors, or a newsroom around his own political objectives. So that would really surprise me. On that second point, though, I mean, when I bought the New Republic, I did purposefully take both the publisher and editor-in-chief titles. And the reason for that was fairly simple. I've been fortunate to have really the best editor anyone could ever imagine, Frank Foer, who spends every day developing the content in our magazine on our iPad app across the publication. But I do think that any ownership and anyone who's trying to transition a media company, as I am and we are at the New Republic, has to think about the nature of that content, how much long-form writing versus photo essays versus video versus graphs and infographics. How does that interact with our ability to advertise or to provide products for advertisers or to monetize across devices? I mean, these things have to be thought about holistically. And I would expect that someone like Jeff would see that, given everything else that we've seen in the digital publishing space that Amazon has started to pioneer over the past few years.
I mean, I can't imagine him not thinking fundamentally about restructuring newspapers. They've been sort of in the process of being restructured willy-nilly for years now. Surely he'll put pedal to the metal on that at some point. Chris, John Harris, Bill Keller, please stand by. Lots of callers want to join us here. Let's go to Buffalo, New York. Brad, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to provide a little bit of a perspective of somebody who's I'm a recent graduate of graduate school.
Okay.
At the University of Buffalo, and there, you know, I'm 25 years old. From that perspective, the university has a free newspaper program where you can get a USA Today and New York Times in the box. There's a lot of students reading those papers. And on a broader point about long-form journalism, I think it's important that we understand that young people ourselves do have a large appetite for this. Often we talk about how important or how big Twitter and the,
yeah,
the cable news cycle is. But look at the top programs on television, 60 Minutes every week, brilliant long-form journalism. Look at podcasts. I can't tell you the number of my friends who love This American Life, which goes mm-hmm. against what people would think. It's a long-form program with long stories, but it's engaging. And I think we need to make sure that both in journalism, you know, journalism overall is not just a snippet thing, and not only young people aren't only driven by short snippets these days.
I'm so glad for that call, Brad. I suppose everybody on the line here is. Keep listening, keep reading. But Bill Keller, let me put it to you. There's Brad in Buffalo. He wants long form. But you know what newspapers have been up against, New York Times not least. Do you see the evidence of that in sufficient numbers to float these organizations?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you can't extrapolate from the New York Times or the Washington Post to every, Metropolitan yeah. Daily. But the fact is, the New York Times has 50 million monthly uniques. That's 50 million people who check in to read serious journalism. I mean, we don't offer cat videos. So, you know, they're coming for the serious stuff. 20% of them are outside of the U.S. So there clearly is an appetite for this, and that's a market. Now, how you supply that market in a profitable way is the big business model question of our day, and different people are working through that different ways. And, you know, I'm delighted that somebody like Jeff Bezos wants to join the quest. But the question of whether there's, mm-hmm. you know, the problem of newspapers isn't that people stopped wanting news.
It's that the profit formula kind of fell apart when the web took away so much advertising and classified. I'm sure you've seen Henry Blodgett writing this month in the Business Insider that the Times could make it on its digital revenues alone, but it would have to cut about 20% of its staff to do that. What do you think of that vision, Bill?
Well, I think the math is basically right. I think the time frame, I think we have more time than he anticipates. And I'm hoping that in that time we can generate enough revenue per subscriber online that we won't have to do the kind of draconian cuts that he prescribes in the newsroom staff. I mean, one of the reasons that the New York Times, I think, has done as well as it has in this really turbulent time is that we have owners, the Sulzberger family, who are committed to keeping the core enterprise intact. And that means that's expensive. You know, we have 1,100 or so journalists. We send people all over the world,
yeah,
including to some very dangerous places that require security.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would not want to suddenly decide that our business model means you have to start whacking at the quality and of the journalists.
John, do you think he'll spend? I mean, I remember as a newspaper reporter, you know, going through Mogadishu, had to hire, what, 8 gunmen in 3 cars to get through the city. Is Jeff Bezos going to put up for that sort of full court press, global press coverage?
My guess is that he anticipates that and that he will. To do otherwise would be to, I think, retreat further from the Washington Post mission. I'd say over the past decade, there's already been a fairly substantial retreat in the scope of that publication's ambitions. The thing that Bill just described, the Washington Post still does that, but it does less of it than it did basically when I was growing up there, and does less of it this year than it did last.
A lot of papers do less. Hmm.
He's right. It is expensive, and it's really hard to, beyond just the expense, it's hard to produce a kind of an ambitious, creative brand of journalism in a newsroom climate of retrenchment.
Liz in Avon, Connecticut. Liz, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I'm just excited about your program today because I'm a graduate of the University of Missouri Journalism School.
Right on.
And when I went to college, I didn't even have the internet yet. So I watched newspapers with my family, where they're both journalists, my sister's a journalist, and they are on their knees right now. So good for the digital geniuses of our age to come in and try to do something differently, because I mean, nothing's worked so far. The New York Times is the only entity that's managed to make this profitable, and something's got to change. And who better than the people that have invented all these fantastic devices that have harnessed the internet, and, you know, hopefully they can turn it around.
Liz, you're breaking up, but I think we've got the gist of it. I'm not sure the Times is free and clear here yet. They've still got plenty of problems. but there's the impulse, you know, thank goodness that we've got the tech genius of the time coming to the rescue. You on board with that, John Harris?
Well, I don't accept the premise that there's only one news organization that's cracked the code, and I don't really have the belief that there is going to be ever kind of one single sort of epiphany in the news business that lights a path for how you have profitable journalism, both at the national level, at the metropolitan daily level. I think there's going to be lots of people, lots of different enterprises experimenting in different ways, and succeeding in different ways. Politico, the news organization that I run and am a co-founder of, we have a different model than what the Washington Post has or what the New York Times has. We're a niche publication, and we've prospered both editorially, I believe, and as a business, we've prospered by trying to dominate that niche and monetizing that journalism. That's quite different than the sort of broad lens that the New York Times has, covering, you know, literally the world.
The world. We'll look at that and more. John Harris with Politico. It's so great to have you here. Chris Hughes, Facebook founder, now owner of The New Republic. Bill Keller, former executive editor of The New York Times. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the future of newspapers as they more or less merge with the digital world. Amazon's Jeff Bezos is buying the Washington Post. Where does this go? Former editor, executive editor of the New York Times, Bill Keller, is with us this hour. John Harris, long time at the Washington Post, but now editor-in-chief and co-founder of Politico, is here. Chris Hughes, a co-founder of Facebook, who purchased The New Republic, is with us from Washington. We've got a lot of callers to get to, Chris, John, Bill, but also a lot of response online. Here's one from Rollo says if you were in a business class and, assuming newspapers did not yet exist, came up with the idea to print news onto paper and truck it out to people's homes in the middle of the night, well, my guess is you would get an F. In 2013, he's probably right. Here's Mary writes to us, yes, I read the Washington Post every day. Online is good for sharing a story, but who can still sit still in front of a screen long enough to read the whole paper or see the ads? There's a problem. And here's Allison, who writes, we live outside New Orleans, where there is no longer a daily paper, just three printings a week, Sunday, Wednesday, Friday. Allison says, I couldn't keep up with the daily paper. This is just the right amount for us. Is that hell to a newspaper man's ears, Bill Keller?
You know, I've indulged a lot in the kind of gloomsaying about the troubles of the industry, but it's worth just pausing for a second to point out that in a lot of ways we are living in the golden age of news. I mean, I can, from my computer, not only access, you know, any newspaper that's still in business and I access a lot of them. I can access newspapers that don't necessarily sell on American newsstands. I follow a couple of newspapers in South Africa, one or two in Russia. I can get them without leaving my desk. There are services that aggregate the news and alert me when something's happened. I can engage the news, react to it, or watch other people react to it. There are specialized sites for nerds of all kinds. I can dig into archives. If I'm reading a story about Egypt and I want to remind myself who Mubarak is and where he came from,
sure.
I can get that. And I can do all of this anytime. I can listen to On Point whenever I feel like listening to On Point. So, you know, for a serious news consumer, and there are lots of us,
yep.
This is not such a bad time.
I mean, all true, and yet you know that the financial structure that has supported serious news gathering has just been burning down around us. You know that.
Yeah.
I mean, your newspaper bought mine, the Boston Globe, what, back in the 90s for $1 billion plus? That just sold for $70 million. You know, the mayor told a friend of mine driving by, the land alone might be worth $50, $60 million. So what are they going to have to, you know, what are they going to have to do to cut? I mean, you've got a baseball, John Henry, Red Sox owner buying it. What are they going to have to do to cut that thing down or turn it around or change it so that to justify the money?
Well, I guess I would just like to echo something that John said earlier. It's an important point. There is no one answer. I mean, and the future is going to be a mix of survivors, places that learn to adapt, as I think the Times has done, although we're, you know, it would be nice to see the revenues going up instead of coming down. There will be a number of survivors, and then there will be a lot of startups. And we've seen, you know, John runs one, Politico. ProPublica has a completely different philanthropic-supported business model. They do investigative journalism and place it in newspapers around the country.
Yeah.
Huffington Post is an aggregation model, which has now begun moving into actually producing original content. There's an outfit in Texas called the Texas Tribune, which is totally online journalism, but makes its money by selling its work to print newspapers across the state.
Boy, you're in a good mood today. I mean, you know, you of course wrote that Huffington Post in Somalia, this would be called piracy, this aggregation.
I've had my issues with the Huffington Post, some of which were intended to be provocation. I mean, we all aggregate from all sorts of sources, but there certainly was a time when a lot of the Huffington Post consisted of things that looked a little bit like larceny. You know, where you, instead of linking to yeah. somebody else's article, you essentially rewrite it or excerpt it so extensively that you never get back to the original producer.
I've got so many questions here, but so do our listeners. Bob in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Bob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm really looking forward to this because I think Bezos has something that nobody else has. He has the infrastructure of Amazon, and by purchasing this, he can take a subscription to the Post and he can offer it to his premium subscribers of Amazon, the ones that get free shipping or whatever.
Yep.
He can automatically put it into the NURC, and he's going to be able to garner advertising dollars because he's going to have a fixed base of accounts that automatically get the Post, and that's never happened before. So I am really looking forward to this.
We're talking synergy here in The View from Stevens Point. Bob, I appreciate your call. Chris Hughes, What about it? Do you think he can pile it into his Amazon empire, do some sort of cross-fertilization here, and come out with some better business model?
Yeah, maybe. There's been a lot of talk of this delivery network and whether or not that's interesting. And I guess that could be. But everything that I've seen signals to me that the innovations are much more around providing content as a service on a through a technological device that makes it easy for people to pay. The question that came up just before about the Boston Globe and the Post, I do think it is a really important one to linger on. The Post has to differentiate itself from the New York Times. And in turn, the Boston Globe has to differentiate itself from the other major daily newspapers. And it is not yet clear, to me at least, that there is a lot of role for local or even regional papers, since, you know, 80% of the news that the people who are reading these things are interested in is going to have been produced elsewhere already. So in many ways, I see this as a bit of a race to who can be the one of the top, let's say, two or three major national news sources on my iPhone or on my Kindle, and obviously the Post and the Times are going to be two racing there, but I think it's going to be a real challenge for a lot of the other institutions underneath them.
This is interesting. John Harris, this brings me right to you. You were at the Post for many years writing politics. You left and you took that political coverage, your chunk of it, with you, built your own online service, brand, Politico. Ross Douthat, writing in Bill's paper, the New York Times, said, you know, you took with you what should have been the Washington Post differentiating focus, and that for the Post to come back and thrive, your outfit, John Harris, Politico, has to die.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's right there in print. I'm just laying it out. What do you think?
Well, I don't accept that premise. Certainly, I don't accept it all the way. I think it wrongly views the competition. I'm talking the journalistic competition as opposed to what we've been talking about in the show, which is a search for a successful business model. The journalistic competition is not in a kind of one-to-one, zero-sum way that Ross described in that column. I do think there's a competition in my area for politics against almost an infinite field of who is setting the agenda, who's producing the most interesting, provocative coverage on any given day.
Yeah, but they're the Washington Post. And, that's the heart of politics, Washington.
Some days. The New York Times might win it some days. Huffington Post might win it some days. The Washington Post might win it some days. I'm not succeeding in my job unless Politico is winning it more often than any of those other folks.
Chris, you're saying the Post has to differentiate. The differentiating factor of Washington, D.C. is politics. Politico's got a big handle on that right now. Does the Post have to fight back? Does Jeff Bezos have to marshal his troops against John Harris's troops to win?
Well, I think the first part of Ross's comments are right. The second part I find a little bit more problematic. I do think that Politico, I mean, to John and Jim and everyone else over there's credit, has massively disrupted the news market in Washington and has taken a lot of the wind out of the Post sails. That said, I also think that what the Post has is a national brand that does politics, culture, society, arts, all kinds of things that if I were in Jeff's shoes, and obviously I'm nowhere near there, but that would be where I would place a lot more emphasis, because the market for that kind of news, as Bill has seen at the Times and the Numbers Show, is very, very large, and arguably larger than just the market for very important, but inside the Beltway insight.
Bill Keller, what about fundamental, never mind the business model exactly for a minute here, but though it's integral to this question, but what about just a reshaping of how news is delivered entirely? It's happening in any case and has been happening for years now, but what about some dramatic moves on that front? I mean, Bezos has been willing to do that in everything he's touched. Maybe the paper will go away or become a super premium high-cost thing just for people who can't get over it. Maybe you'll have all kinds of new software embedded in the news product that will let people do more things with it. I don't know. Do you see a new product shape perhaps coming with this digital guy at the helm, Bill?
Yeah, I think the new delivery device will be a chip implanted in our brains, where it's just immediately downloaded cortex.
Yeah.
Look, you know, Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher of The Times, has been predicting for years that print will die, and it sort of got to a point where he began worrying that he was demoralizing his own troops, so he's qualified that a bit. But, you know, 5 years from now, will there still be print newspapers? Yes. 20 years from now, will there still be print newspapers? I'm not so sure. I mean, except in the sense that there are still vinyl records that you can buy, you know, as a sort of boutique product for aficionados. Print will probably go, will certainly go away as the main delivery vehicle, and may go away altogether. I mean, I will miss print if I'm still alive in those days, because I like the feel of it and the portability of it and all of that. But there, you know, basically, what's the fastest growing delivery device for news now is mobile phones. You know, that's going to continue to grow in the coming years, and eventually print probably will go away.
I mean, I spent some time in the dot-com world and a whole lot of time in the news world, and I'm thinking a lot about different ways the news might be delivered. I can't imagine Jeff Bezos won't. It seems like everybody is. Judy in Brooklyn, New York. Judy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, my concern is about content. I'm a community activist, and I have been up against Mayor Bloomberg on many privatization schemes of our public parks, with condos, eminent domain for sports arenas, telling us which size soda we're going to eat. So what happens when Bloomberg, who is now rumored to be maybe taking over the New York Times, what happens with the nexus of a political agenda, somebody who has aspired to higher office, is now in charge of our content, you know, no matter how it's delivered, and he has a clear agenda? How do you guys feel about it, specifically Mr. Keller?
Okay, we'll do that. I mean, sticking with Bezos for a second, I don't know his politics. We'll look at that. But Bill, there's a question from your backyard. Judy in Brooklyn wants to know, is Mayor Bloomberg going to end up buying your newspaper and bringing his politics with him?
I doubt it very much. The Sulzberger family has been quite emphatic in saying the Times is not for sale. And, you know, although, you know, we haven't found the complete magic formula yet, I don't think there's any reason why it would be for sale, because things are trending in the right direction. You've got to remember that Michael Bloomberg already owns a media empire. He has a very robust, you know, wire service with TV and radio components. So he has no shortage of opportunity to get his views out there.
But, I mean, let's look at Bezos. Judy, I don't know if that's satisfactory for you. And, of course, nobody says, well, they don't always say they're selling until it's done. So who knows? Future unknowable.
You know, way in there.
Yeah, John?
I mean, we're really in an era of infinite competition. And I do think that means the Citizen Kane era of journalism is really over, where somebody could be a press baron and use that to kind of impose their agenda.
Excuse me, Rupert Murdoch, we know him.
Nothing more than look ridiculous and end up eroding the value of their own franchise, because they would just be, there would be derision heaped upon him.
Rupert Murdoch, Roger Ailes?
Roger's in is certainly a different case, because what he's done is taken a niche formula on, not on subject grounds, but on ideological grounds. So, sure, he's a media baron of the sort, but if Rupert Murdoch tried to use the Wall Street Journal to advance his regulatory interests, he would look ridiculous, and he would vastly harm the value of his asset in the Wall Street Journal.
I mean, you may be right, but I mean, you know, liberals look at the Murdoch Empire and cringe. Conservatives look at, but you know, Sulzberger politics and aren't so happy about what they see. I mean, Chris Hughes, you know, here I'm reading from the LA Times. David Horsey had a wonderful column on this, raising questions about Bezos, and this kind of goes to Judy's question. But you know, does he really understand the core mission of journalism? Is the question that Horsey raises in the LA Times. He says, you know, this is a business that engages in hard-hitting reporting that alienates customers, provokes the ire of important leaders in government and the corporate world. The best news organizations will spend great amounts of money on endeavors such as investigative reporting, far-flung news bureaus that will never be profit centers. You think Bezos is really to take all that on, Chris?
I mean, that's why these brands are valuable in the first place. I think that that's why people look to the Washington Post or the New York Times or some of these other pretty pristine brands for the kind of journalism that they do.
But that was built with decades behind us of principled work. That doesn't mean that it'll be ahead of us. You could ride a brand into the ground.
You could, but that would be certainly not in his own financial or professional self-interest. Look, I think that the fact that the brands that people like Jeff are interested in are creatures of their history, there's certainly a respect there for them, but there's also a realization that that brand carries a weight. People know it, people respect it, and as a result, they're more likely to pay for it than they would if it's just some upstart that's on their phone. You look at the Times, again, to just use as an example because it's top of mind, you've got 300,000 people paying $450 a year just for digital access to that kind of journalism. That's not something that you treat lightly, or it's very easy to replicate from any startup.
Well, I've got to think, Bill Keller, that just the news of Jeff Bezos, Amazon founder, big innovator, big disruptor, moving into the Washington Post, will have everybody else in the print news business and all over looking to move even more aggressively into online development, Bill. That, you know, if Bezos is coming in, we better be on our game digitally, because surely he will.
Well, not to mention the fact that $250 million he spent to buy the Post was 1% of his income. Yeah. He could spend 1% more of his income and invest it in buying back some of the reporters and editors who've been downsized at the Post and be a real competitive threat, more of a competitive threat to places like the Times.
The drama rolls on. It's going to be an incredible thing to watch Bezos move in here and see over time what he does with this big name in American journalism, The Washington Post. Bill Keller at The New York Times, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today, Bill.
It's a pleasure.
John Harris, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Politico. Good luck, John. Thanks for joining us.
Appreciate it. So long.
And Chris Hughes, co-founder of Facebook, now owner of The New Republic. Chris, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.